on networks from indeed a mathematical point of view, what you might call generic applied probability. And it's an interest that's grown with collaboration with David Aldous upon actual spatial networks which might arise, for example, in transportation. So you might think of transportation networks, roads, rail, even air. You might be thinking about congestion in these networks, or simply about how efficient these networks were in some sense. And there are other kinds of networks as well which have this kind of spatial embodied notion. The questions which we want to bring are how to view a network from the point of view of a designer. What are the optimality criteria? How may they interact? And also how to model the networks in rather generic ways. So I'm going to describe a stochastic geometric model that will impact both on questions of design and then in a development also upon trying to model a kind of abstract form of these networks. But before talking about anything abstract, we ought to be specific and we ought to try and do some cross-cultural liaison. And so my first slide takes us back a matter of a mere 2,000 years. Or it would, if I could get this thing to work. My clicker's not working.
I can try.
So I've... It may not have switched on. The clicker's not clicking. Because it's... So this is the problem with having a talk at the start by a theoretician, because they can't actually switch their clicker on. So I'm going to talk about, firstly, a transportation network that fascinates many small children in the United Kingdom. That's the network of Roman roads, which was established when we were first civilized by Europe. And clearly this network was built for a purpose. It was important for trade. It was also important for, how can I say, polite forms of control. If the equivalent of the football crowd up here got out of hand and started getting a bit rowdy, then a Roman emperor would want to tell his bodies of persuasive people with sharp implements here and maybe there to move as quickly as possible to where the disturbance was taking place and to persuade these people in some pointed way to go back home quickly or else. So they had to get quickly from one part of Britain to the other. So naturally, you can see the network is kind of focused upon this. There are lots of very nearly straight lines. And Roman roads in Britain are famous for being extremely straight, even when it would seem logical to go around something. They just go straight through. Not too much trouble with planning those days. But there is another problem, and that is, and I see that in Texas yesterday you experienced something of the same. Britain is famous for its weather. And thus, the more roads you put down, the more you have to pay to keep them up in the British winter and repair them. And so a Roman emperor might very well have looked at the problem of building Roman roads in Britain and thought, on the one hand, they want a road straight between any one place and any other place for the purposes of persuasion. And on the other hand, they don't want too many Roman roads because that will cost them money, and Roman emperors were always worrying about money. And so the Roman emperor might have said in Latin, pro optima, quod faciendum est, what is the best thing to do? He has, in fact, what we now know as a frustrated optimization problem. On the one hand, he wants to build road networks which give as quick connections as possible between any two random places. On the other hand, he wants to minimize the total amount of road used. And clearly, achieving one will damage the other objective, so there has to be some kind of trade-off. So, first interest is, what can you say about that sort of trade-off if you're interested in designing networks like this? How can you help Roman emperors with their job? And there are many more contemporary examples that one could describe. having got into this, and I shall describe briefly the sorts of answers we got out later, having got into this, one can then start asking about networks in general, how you might design, how you might produce a sort of generic model for networks, particularly ones which have a sort of invariance about them in some statistical way. So here is my second slide. Google holidays for cats. This is a particular issue for me. I live in Coventry, which is a very distinguished city in Britain with a very great history. And I often go on holiday in a most beautiful part of Britain called the Peak District. And naturally, when I want to go from one to the other, I look up on Google Maps or Bing or OpenStreetMap and get some kind of route between the two. It's complicated because our holiday is for the cat as well. And the cat is fine on motorways, but has some difficulties every time we go round a roundabout. So really, our optimization criterion ought to involve the bare minimum of roundabouts between Coventry and the Peak District. Unfortunately, that's not possible, and sometimes it goes unpleasantly wrong, both from the cat's point of view and from ours as we travel up. But basically, we start off in Coventry doing a very windy route over relatively slow roads. We hit motorways. We then start going faster, then a less major road, and then finally some very windy roads around there. And what you see there is actually the route which Google Maps would provide for us. So, a number of things to observe. Firstly, if there are a number of sources and destinations you want to go to and from, you can make a network out of this just by connecting all of these sources and destinations using the prescribed routes by Google or Bing or by OpenStreetMap. Secondly, if you look at this, it's almost plausible that there's a kind of scale invariance going on. If you look at the blow-up regions, then they don't look too different from the major route itself. So the question is it sensible to talk about a kind of scale-invariant network, which is produced as follows? You've got your plane, you pick some source destinations over the plane, you connect them up by routes, and now you've got what you might think of as a random network. And what you want is a scale invariance that if a number of your source destinations are in a small area and you zoom into that, then statistically at least you see the same kind of network in that region as you saw in the larger region. I mean, this is clear, isn't it? It might or might not be possible to do this. But if it was, then it would be something like a scale invariant model for this route finding. And another thing to notice is that in this sort of thing, there appears to be a kind of hierarchy. One tends to start off on slow routes and then move on faster routes and then back down on slow routes again. So one might expect, if one was able to produce such a model, a hierarchy to build up of fast versus slow routes in some sense. So here are then these two slides, and there are quite vaguely expressed questions. On the one hand, in your network, how do you resolve this question of the competing optimization criteria of minimizing the amount of connection, but at the same time minimizing the average distance between two random points? Secondly, how might you more generally produce a model for networks produced by sampling points and connecting them in this sort of way? So let me talk about results for the first of these problems. Let's model Britain by a flat featureless rectangle of size root n, where n is large, and we're going to talk about asymptotics as n goes to infinity. I know very well Britain is not like this, although possibly parts of the United States are, but this is where we start to get a notion in the traditional means of applied mathematics of approximating something by its very broad features. As I've described, we want network connecting, shall we say, n cities in the rectangle size root n. That means a sort of density of cities of 1. I'm not saying whether these cities are going to be randomly placed or not. The results are insensitive to that. They could be cities placed deliberately in a certain pattern or randomly. How do we measure the efficiency of the network one measure, minimising the amount of connecting stuff. We know how to do this. You construct the Steiner tree. How to do this in the sense that we know in principle the theory of the Steiner tree. We don't actually know in the sense of being able to say we have a polynomial time algorithm and therefore we can claim $1 million from the Clay Institute. So this is itself quite interesting. But the Steiner tree is going to minimize the connecting stuff. It's not going to be very good for connecting things with minimum distance between an average pair of points, because it's a tree. And you can clearly end up with two points which are geometrically close to each other, but along the tree you're going to have to go down nearly to the root and then back up again over a long distance compared with the straight distance as the crow flies. So Steiner tree is not going to be great for minimising, what shall we say, the average excess of connection distance over the straight Euclidean connection. On the other hand, if we wanted to measure, minimise objective B, then the right thing to do would be to use the complete Euclidean graph connecting these points, and that would clearly be very expensive, and you can do the math. And you see that you essentially have polynomials in N for each of these in an unhelpfully anti-cooperating way. So the first piece of work with Aldous was to produce a compromised network and to try to do as well as possible. Let's just do some figures here. If I can read correctly, the length of a Steiner tree would be order N, where the rectangle is size root N. Length root N. And the complete graph would be, I could do this in my head and I haven't written it down. The length of it would be large. I'm not going to try and do this sum in my head. And the question is, how do you resolve these two? You expect for the Steiner tree, to improve on that, you're going to have to get closer to a Euclidean connection, and therefore you're going to have to use substantially more than order n of connection distance. But it turns out you don't. So the Aldous Kendall recipe, you start with a Steiner tree connecting all the points. So you've got your connection, it's just not efficient. You add a sparse set of random lines. So it's as if you're a Roman emperor and you're just saying, I'll have a road going that way and a road going that way and a road going that way, and you've connected them without any design. You're just putting down these lines at random. And then to help matters along, you add a sparse rectilinear grid connecting the lines in the tree. And I should say by sparse, I mean the average length of what I'm adding is contributing only infinitesimally much compared with the root n of the Steiner tree. So it's not increasing the length very much. And then, in fact, you add some box structures to avoid hotspots, and the resulting network is economical with the connection stuff in that it is Steiner tree length, order root n, plus something of little o of root n. So Steiner tree, did I say root n? Steiner tree is order n, so it's little o of n, but on the other hand, the excess Euclidean distance, which is the other thing we want to measure, is only logarithmic in n. So the excess distance being logarithmic in n means that you've essentially got as good connections as the complete graph. So here is how you resolve that frustrated optimization problem. You do the excellent in one way, expensive in another way Steiner tree. You put down a few random lines, infinitesimal contribution to the length, relatively, and then a little bit of twiddles also, not contributing very much to the length, and hey, you've got something almost as good as Euclidean connections. So that's quite a striking result. I'm not going to say that this clearly motivated the Roman emperor to produce connections of the way he did, but it explains why that network works. You could actually run this another way, and you could say this thing that you can convert any network, if you can convert the Steiner tree, you can probably do it for any, into an efficient kind of connection in the sense of Euclidean. That's saying that the average excess criterion is not a very good criterion for measuring networks, because very small perturbations of any network will give you as good as you can get there. So another way of viewing this work is that it debunks the natural statistic for network efficiency, which is minimizing the average excess of connection distance. You pay your money, you take your choice. And, yes?
So, on the line, they don't pass through cities, necessarily?
No, not at all.
Okay,
so... I mean, it is really, they're random. So, this is a randomized algorithm for producing a doubly efficient network. Well, we know about that sort of thing in algorithmic design, and here it is in transportation. Yes? Charles?
Is there an optimization problem for which this is a solution? In other words, you seem to have...
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer. So, yeah, there could be some linear combination of the two criteria, for example.
Another question. Perhaps you'd want to do the standard tree after you put down the lines. Because once you have the lines anyway, why would you want to be stuck with...
Can I have this on my debit account at the end? Right, if I ever run. Yes, you could do it that way. What this is saying is you don't have to. Yes, you could obviously put down the lines first and then only put down the bits that you need. But this is saying you don't have to be that intelligent to produce a very satisfactory resolution. All right.
You don't need the symmetry.
Yeah. So, but we haven't checked it, but in principle we believe that there's another kind of tree you can produce to connect things, named temporally flow in my mind, and you could probably use that as well, though we haven't checked the details. Minimum spanning tree, thank you. Yes. Few more results. You might ask whether the logarithmic upper bound for this mean connection distance is sound, whether we're actually missing some even cleverer design. There are approximations used in producing this logarithmic upper bound, but what one can check is that the approximations are of the right order. Essentially, it's not only that the upper bound on the excess distance is logarithmic, but you wouldn't be able to do any better by adding random lines. We can control, this is only about the mean distance, we can control the fluctuations by bounding the variance of the excess connection distance. That's an interesting excursion into the theory of Levy processes in probability. And we can also ask about flows in the network. So if in the network you're getting between any pair of points an infinitesimal amount of flow, and then you integrate that over the whole network, then you can get sharp answers about what happens, for example, to the flow right in the middle of the network. And there are many other things besides. But I want to move on to talk more about the second problem now. So I've talked a bit about this frustrated optimization problem, but now, having talked about that, having got the notion that random lines are a useful sort of thing to add in, I now want to talk about how we might turn to the second problem and model this kind of scale-invariant network as a kind of generic model for these transportation networks. To do that, I want to talk a bit first about random line processes. And I'm going to be a little mathematical about this and talk about the most significant generalization of line processes in d-dimensional space. And I'm going to do that partly because some of the results I'm going to talk about will be very interesting when one's designing not just networks in two dimensions, but higher. So I want to talk about how you would produce random lines. What do you mean by, for example, a Poisson, not a Poisson point process, but a Poisson process of lines on the plane, or more generally, in RD? So I shall draw the planar case. And I want to know what I mean by building a pattern of random lines like that, which I would require to be Poisson in some sensible way. Well, of course, you know the answer is you should go and buy a copy of the book that I helped write on stochastic geometry and its applications, and it will tell you how to do this. But as a taster, I'm just going to describe the idea now. The idea is very simple. if you try and produce these random lines directly, then you get into problems because a random line doesn't really have a location. It's sort of spread out all over its line. And in the end, that means any sort of way of sort of building it up bit by bit becomes inconvenient, at least for definitional purposes. So instead, you want to parameterize the line process by parameterizing each line as a point on some representing space. And then you will, given up if a point on this representing space produces a line on the plane, then you just have a Poisson pattern of points on the representing space, and that will correspond to your line process. So the question is, what is the right representing space to look at? Now, if you're a mathematician, you say this is just so trivial, it's obvious that the lines on the plane should be modelled by the puncture projective plane. Clear. Or if you're wanting something more concrete, then what you can say is, let's put down a reference line and a reference point on that line. Let's parameterize each line by its angle theta and the perpendicular distance from the reference point. And that will give me r and theta. And r will be a signed distance because this r is different from the r going in the other direction. And theta will belong to 0 to pi. And I'm saying from 0 to pi because I'm excluding any sense of direction of these lines. A line going that way is viewed as the same as the line going the opposite way. So the natural range for theta is from 0 to pi. And what one gets as a result, then, is what you might call a twisted cylinder. Or, if you like, an infinite Möbius band. But the important thing about this is that the stationary geometry, Euclidean geometry of the plane, induces a measure upon the space which is invariant under translations, and that's just 1/2 dr d theta. It almost looks like polar coordinates. It isn't, actually, because there's no r in front of the dr. And a little thought about what it means to say that the measure on the line space should be stationary under translations and rotations tells you that dr and d theta are the right things to put here. And you can check invariance then by calculation. And you can do this also in the higher dimensional case. You parameterize by the direction of the line, which is now on a point not on 0 to pi, but on a point essentially of a hemisphere, actually a projective space, and a location, not r, but now a vector x, which is on the hyperplane, which is perpendicular to the direction. And then you have a similar invariant measure for this. Once you've got an invariant measure, then you know what you mean by a Poisson process of points on the representing space in any region. The number of points in this region has got to be Poisson, with the mean being the measure of that region under this invariant measure. And then you have produced a Poisson process of these objects, lines in higher dimensional space, lines on the plane, which has geometric invariance statistically. In all these cases, the coordinate x or r is twisted by the direction omega or theta, but the geometric inconvenience there isn't actually noticed by the measure theory. You can regard it essentially as a direct product. Okay. So now I can talk about, having got that line process, how we would produce a scale-invariant random spatial network. And this is going to the Google Holidays for Cats example. What you have to think of then is you're picking a number of points in the plane, not necessarily random, and you want to connect them up by routes. And how might you do this with the help of line processes? So first of all, you input the set of nodes you want to connect. You will produce an output which is a random network of connecting the nodes. And these will be random paths And I haven't yet said how we're going to build these paths. Eventually, we're going to build them using some generalization of the Poisson line process. You want this to be scale invariant. So under any Euclidean similarity, the statistical distribution of the network of points has got to be invariant or strictly equivariant under this similarity. If we rotate this network, it's statistically the same as the network we produce by rotating the individual points. If we scale the network, it's the same as the network we produce by scaling the individual points. Now, you can think of all sorts of networks, rules you could use for producing these things, but here are some further things that are natural to require. We want the rotes that we produce to have finite mean lengths. So let's think of the route that we produce between two points, shall we say unit distance apart. It doesn't really matter what distance they are because of the scaling property in part one up there. We want that mean distance to be finite. So that would rule out quite a lot of recipes because they produce these paths by some complicated statistical construction and you discover to your dismay that the paths you were thinking of would all be of mean infinite length and that wouldn't be very good as a model. But there's another rather subtle property that we also want. If this is a network of some sense of best paths, I'm using fastest as a metaphor for best, then we'd expect if you're going from A to B, that path should be useful for producing a connection between C close to A and D close to B. So we'd expect quite a lot of reuse of paths. Here's one path going from A to B produced by this network. Here are two other points, and we'd expect that the path from C to D might well reuse part of the first path from A to B. And we can axiomatize this. Let's consider now, genuinely, those points x1 up to xn or further are produced by a unit intensity Poisson point process in the plane. So we're scattering points at random all over the plane. We're connecting each pair of points using the whatever rule it is that we're talking about for connecting nodes, whatever statistical construction we have in mind. That's going to produce a network for stochastic geometers, a fiber process. The weak Zerson property is that the average length per unit area of the resulting network should be finite. So there's so much reuse going on if we have an infinite collection of points scattered all over the network that even though in principle you could have infinite numbers of pairs of points connecting their way through a particular region, they're all going to be using only a finite collection of paths in that particular region, which are the fastest ways to go. So even though it's spread out everywhere, in any particular region, we only see a finite length of network. In fact, a finite mean length of network there.
Question.
Yeah.
So for any pair of points of the Euclidean space, there will exist a route between these two points?
Let's be careful about sets of probability zero. Because, you know, if I want a path between any pair of points at all, then I'm sort of taking a construction where x and y are varying over a continuum. So that could be awkward. So let's start off with a Poisson point pattern, which is just a countable selection of points. So that's controlled. There's no ugly measure theoretic particularities there. Now, the strong Zerson property says, if we go on adding points, so if we add superpose another unit intensity Poisson process and another one and another one and another one, eventually we're going to build a huge network. In any particular region, there are all these points, if we go on adding, there's going to be a dense set of points here, and they're going to produce an infinite amount of connection stuff. So let's be a little strict. Let's say we're only going to count the paths once they have got more than unit distance away from the start and before they get unit distance close to the finish. So we're talking about the middle bit, what you might call the first part of the network, once you've got onto the motorways. In some crude way, we're just saying once we've got unit distance away and before we get unit distance to the destination, that's the region we'll consider. In that case, if we do that construction of continually superposing more and more unit intensity point, Poisson point processes to get a dense pattern of points everywhere, if we look at a particular region and the point pairs starting or finishing in that region, we're not going to count those paths. We're only going to count the sort of the longer distance, the fast routes going through, and the strong Sersenne property says if we do that superposition, then we will end up still with only a finite mean length per unit area. Got that? So it's answering your question, and it was the next thing I wanted to say. Now, really, we're thinking now of connecting every pair of points. But let's not think about that, because we're connecting every pair of a dense set of points. So essentially, that's going to do the job for us. From this point of view of axiomatizing anything, in any particular case, we can then go on and say, let's just check that this means we can actually connect any pair of points by appropriate approximation. But for the purposes of axiomatization, then, we'll just stay with that. I don't think I've written down a sort of 3A, which is the strong Sersenne property. But you get, I hope that discussion gives you the notion of this, which is the crucial thing about these networks. We need the mean distance between any two points to be finite, but we also need the total contribution from an infinite network in any particular region to be a finite mean length. And that somehow arguably captures what we mean by a scale invariant random spatial network. And Olders has gone on to prove that just from these axioms you can find out all sorts of interesting things. In particular, you can show the existence of what you might call portals. You will be able, this is work by Bast and others, you'll be able to find a finite set of points, locally finite set of points, such that if you're going a substantial distance from A to B, then what you'll do is first go to the nearest of these portal points, and then you'll follow a predetermined route till you get to a portal nearer to your conclusion, and then you'll, as it were, fall off onto the slow network again. And this heuristic has been formulated before, but the Sersenne axiomatization shows it will happen, something like that phenomenon, whenever you've got these axioms satisfied, and so forth. Actually, that's my next slide. Yep. Paths exhibit portal behavior. It's fine to produce a set of axioms. Mathematicians do this all the time. But unless you've got something which realizes your set of axioms, you may be talking about nothing. There are famous examples of people building huge theories based upon axioms, in fact, in which there is only one single trivial and uninteresting example. So are there any interesting networks which actually exhibit this Sersenne behavior? So Olders 2014 shows there's a kind of hierarchical binary model, which is a little artificial, but which nevertheless produces Sersenne behavior. What's the idea? You connect points only on a kind of Manhattan plan, where you have a rectilinear Cartesian network. The network itself is dense because it's dyadic, that's to say, it includes all lines y equals some dyadic rational and x equals some dyadic rational. And you have a notion of speed so that as you get dyadic rationals which go further and further down the depth of the dyadic rationals, the paths get slower and slower, and so you're going to use them only for short-range work. That's a very lattice structure. It's very not rotationally invariant. It's not even scale invariant. But by randomizing rotation and scale, you can force the spatial invariance. And that, it's a substantial amount of work, exhibits Sersenne behavior. But there is another, and I think better model, also proposed by Olders, to do with line processes. You use line processes for the connections. Now, a line process of the kind I've described here, it's got a finite intensity upon the representing space, and you can show that the amount of line in any one region is of mean finite length, and in any one region only finitely many lines will intersect. And short story, if you want to connect A to B, you can't get onto the line process in general because there will be no lines passing through it. So what do? You superpose more and more line processes to build a pattern of lines which is dense everywhere. And as you go on superposing, you superpose slower and slower speed lines. And then what you ask for is paths which follow the line process, but such that as you travel along the path, you only travel on the speed of the line you're on, and you try and minimize the time you take from A to B. So you've got a kind of chronological metric to see how you choose the paths. Yes, Charles?
I can see the hierarchy and the scale invariance coming in as a recipe or a guide to producing solutions. What I'm not quite seeing is there an abstract sense in which there is an optimization problem which demands that these solutions be hierarchical or scale invariant? Is that something forced on us by the optima, or is it a useful thing in producing good solutions?
So it's a good question, and the answer is essentially this remark about paths exhibiting portal-like behavior. The 2014 paper shows there are going to be, in some loose sense, a fast network that you have to get onto by going through particular sets of points. I don't think there's any optimization other than... I think the question about whether there is something you optimize is an interesting and thought-provoking question. But you can say, given those axioms, you will see that kind of behavior that looks as if there is something being optimized. But the stage we're at now, we have the stage we have just completed... And I have to check time to make sure I'm not going to go over, but I'm okay.
We have a little over 10 minutes at the moment.
Yeah, a little more than 10 minutes, I hope, yes. The stage we're at now is that we have not just this somewhat artificial model, but also the Poisson line process model for realizing the axiomatization. And frankly, that's the highest priority. You've got to know that there's something there to study. So... let me go into a little more detail about this Poisson line process then. As another way of thinking about this, instead of superposing lots of lines, is you say that instead of modeling a line process, you're going to model a line plus speed process. So now your parameterizing space isn't just your original parameterizing space, but it's the Cartesian product of that with a positive half line which is measuring speed. And the intensity measure is not just on the representing space, but it's also giving the speed as well. And the relevant intensity measure, well, we're representing space now parameterized by V, speed, as well as the parameterization by R and theta, or more generally. And to achieve the scale invariance, you're forced into a intensity in the representing space like this. So the speed has a density which is gamma minus 1 by 2, V to the minus gamma. And we want gamma greater than 1, otherwise you have fast lines close to everything. The line process is then going to be dense through the whole plane, essentially, because V to the minus gamma has an infinite integral over the whole half line. But lines of speed exceeding any threshold, if gamma is greater than 1, or in D dimensions gamma greater than D minus 1, I think it should have been, is going to be a proper line process with only locally finite pattern of lines. Now, the technical bit. What is a path? We use lines to go from A to B as fast as is legally possible, and there are various possibilities. One is that you find that when you do the optimization for a particular gamma, you find in the end that going as fast as possible involves traveling more or less on a straight line. Or you might find that you can't even get going, that all lines take an infinite amount of time to go from one place to another. For which gamma might we get a decent network? So we stick the shortest path lines, shortest time lines. We can talk about a maximum speed limit, which is just at any one point the fastest you can go. Most places the maximum speed is going to be zero. But on the lines it's going to be whatever is the fastest V of a line passing through that point. And you can talk about paths which integrate that kind of measurable speed limit, obeying the orientation field defined by the line pattern, so they're always travelling along lines and obeying the speed limit. If gamma is greater than d, then there's an a priori random bound on the distance you can travel on such a path in any fixed time. And then by a little functional analysis, you can show that the space of paths up to time t has closed, indeed weakly closed, and in fact, if beginning in a compact set, forms a weakly compact set. And what that is saying then is that if you have pi paths at all, if it's possible to go from A to B in a finite time, then you can also go in a shortest time, and those pi geodesics can produce the connections to build up your network. So, if we can show it's possible to connect in finite time, we can show there are shortest connections once gamma is greater than d. Here is how you do the construction of paths. You construct between your start and end, psi 1 and psi 2, you construct small balls. And you connect those balls by the fastest line intersecting both balls. On that fastest line, you construct daughter nodes closest to source and destination. And then you do the same thing to connect psi 1 to the first daughter node and the second daughter node to psi 2, and you recurse. Borel, Cantelli, and a little analysis show there's an almost sure existence of a resulting path, and what's more, that has a finite time to go from A to B. And a similar but more complicated construction allows you simultaneously to construct finite time paths between any source pair destination. That answers your question. In this particular case, you can now really put flesh on the bones, and you can say, yes, this happens. So what we've produced, essentially, is a random metric space. I challenge you to try and visualize this in three dimensions. In two dimensions, it's quite easy because the lines intersect. And so you can see you're going to start slow, work up to high speed, go where you want to go, and then work down again. In three dimensions, none of these lines intersect. So I don't know, I can't say how you're going to start, but once you're on a line, if you want to change direction, you've got to change down gears and then change up again. Except every time you move down onto a slower speed line, you have to change down gears and change up again even to get onto the slower line. And every time you do that, you know, it's a very fractal-like construction. The only model I can think of is it's like one of the old Model T Fords. Every time you move, it stalls. Between the instants that it stalls, it still stalls. Between those instants, it stalls. It's a very jerky process. Sorry? Thank you. There's a picture to describe the construction. You see the first line, L here. Here are the daughter nodes. You make connections there. You just carry on. Okay. Actually, there's more being proved very recently. Remarkable work by Kahn has shown that you can actually produce something you call the pi diameter in a given ball. You can talk about the longest time it takes to go as fast as possible between two points in the ball. And there's actually an exponential bound upon that time, or rather a fractional power of that time there. Now, there's quite a lot of cleanup required now. To make this get close to being a system, you have to know that these geodesics are almost surely unique. You have to know that they're almost surely of finite mean length. You could, in principle, have a geodesic which is as fast as possible between two points, but which has infinite mean length. Think, for example, of going from Austin to Dallas, but finding your fastest route actually takes you somewhere through Alaska. Right. So, in principle, you can get to a position where the finite mean length isn't finite. And then you also have finally to show the Sersenne property. Given the time, I'm going to pass very quickly over the technical aspects of this. So, but first, here are some simulations of the sorts of sets of roots you see. For gamma is 2.1, which is just above the threshold gamma level of 2, for which you can do the construction. This is what you get if you connect the purple points here to the squares here by fastest roots. As gamma increases, so you start seeing more and more direct connections. And as our gamma gets up to, 16, it's beginning to look rather more like the complete bipartite graph between these two points. So as gamma increases, so you get closer and closer just to having straight line connections. But for small gamma, you can see that reuse of paths very much in evidence. There are portals, as it were, that you have to go to from the squares to get onto fast routes which will connect you to other portals which will connect you to your destination. Other unique? I think the answer to this is yes. So in two dimensions, it's rather easier to deal with because lines in two dimensions intersect, and I'm just going to run over, not explain these, but just to say there is a technical argument to show that almost surely between any two points there will be a unique fastest time path in this construction. That's not to say that there won't be pairs of points where there are two fastest time constructions. So not every pair of points has a unique geodesy, but if you pick two points, then with probability one you'll get a unique pi geodesic. Okay. Do they have finite mean lengths? Well, yes, again, given the time, I'm just going to have to skip over the technicalities of this, but it's possible to show by dividing up the amount of time taken to go from A to B, the time spent when you're within a ball containing both A and B, and the time spent outside. There's a nice argument, again, using Levy process type constructions involving perpetuities to show that you will have finite mean length there. So we've got most of these. We've only got the Sersenne property left, which is to say the sufficient path reuse to show that when you're connecting up a whole Poisson point pattern, you will only get a finite mean intensity of total path in any particular region, or the more stronger variant. Until very recently, I didn't know how to do this, but I did know how to prove a kind of pre-Sersenne property. If you have a whole Poisson point process of points and you connect those up, you can at least ask, in any particular region, does the resulting fragments of path, ensemble of paths, is that finite? Does it have finite length in that region? Not whether the mean is finite, but does it have finite length? It's hard to see how you could end up with a construction which would give you finite length but infinite mean length, but it's much easier to show the weaker property, the pre-Sersenne property. And it's a construction like this. You can show the existence of structures such that it's a positive chance of a structure existing such that all the points in there connect to all the points outside only by paths which go first to A and then to B and don't otherwise enter this region in here. So essentially a construction like that showing that all points in here are connected to all points in here by paths starting first in the square, then going through just this single path here from A to B, and then somewhere outside of the square to where it is. Once you've shown that, then a scaling argument shows that you have this pre-Sersenne property. You will only have in any particular region, you will only see a total finite length of connection there. Right. Kahn actually just, at the beginning of this year, produced on archive a proof that not just the weak Sersenne property, also the strong Sersenne property holds for all dimensions and for all gamma great and d, the permissible thing. So we have actually these Sersennes not just for the plane, but also for three space, any higher dimensional space you like. Very remarkable piece of work. It's going to appear in Annals of Probability in due course, and it's based upon that high diameter exponential moment I described here. Strictly, it's an exponential moment of this fractional power of the pi diameter. So, substantial code reuse, and that's just a verbal summary of the pigeonhole, but I'm getting very close to my end, so I should move to my conclusion now. What have we got? Something interesting in many ways. We've got scale invariant random metric spaces, actually, bearing in mind your comment here, we can produce natural random metric spaces in RD which have this invariance under scale, but visualization of these paths is interesting in D greater than 2. In the case of the plane, we've got a Cersen using this construction, and thanks to Kahn, we know this holds in all dimensions. Let's talk about some things we don't know. Think of just the ordinary planar case. You want to connect this point to this point. You have this recursive construction, which says, firstly, most of the connection is going to be done by a very fast line. To get to the very fast line, you're going to use rather slower lines. To get to those slower lines, you're going to use slower lines still. You know, sort of, that your geodesic is going to start at slow speeds, work up, get onto that fast line, then go down again. But that's just a candidate path to show a path exists. What does the geodesic set path itself look like? It seems intuitively clear that the path is never going to do the following. It's never going to start off, move up to a fast line, and then slow down again to a stop, and then start off again, and then go to a move to a fast line until it gets to its destination. In other words, a pi geodesic, we expect, will never stop on the way. Can't prove it. Just seems obvious. So I think that's the big question left unresolved here. There's also a contemporary question in pure mathematics. There's a very interesting combinatorial construction of maps based on Brownian motion, which are metric spaces on the plane. And Kahn highlights the Poisson line Cersen in two dimensions with gamma equals 3 as having strong relationships to these Brownian maps. It can't be the case that they are the same. That would just be stupid. But it would be interesting to see how close the resemblances are. And I'll finish by noting various papers which fill out the body of this work. And I'm going to finish with a slide pretty much on time, bearing in mind the helpful questions I've had. Here is a very old network. This is 2,000 years old. It's a network which connected once all of the major sheep trading and monasteries in the north of England. You drove your sheep along these paths, so it seems an appropriate picture to finish with to say I'll be happy to answer any more questions you might want to ask now. Thank you.
Long break, so we have time for questions. Is there any questions?
Yeah.
So, this last construction, so actually, if you change the cities, you will have to change the complete construction, so, right?
If I move one city, then all the paths going to that city will alter.
Yes.
Although if I don't move it very far, then I will generally expect the paths not to move very much.
Okay.
Except that in some cases, there certainly are pairs of points which have two shortest geodesics. And in that case, if my source and destination are close to these two and they move, I could expect a sudden big change. Another question I could have said is, when there are multiple geodesics between two points, is it only two, or can there be three geodesics between them? And I don't know the answer to that, too. But that sort of nails your question, doesn't it? Generally, you expect not much sensitivity, but there must be cases in which there will be quite big changes to allow for the non-uniqueness of geodesics, which one can show must exist. There must be non-unique geodesics.
The closest thing that comes to mind when the question you raised at the end is dynamic programming, right? Obviously, all shortest path problems have to have some dynamic programming principle.
So those pictures I produced were based on the... Oh, my memory's going... I hope it's just jet lag. There are two algorithms you can use for constructing shortest paths on graphs. And it uses the one which is like matrix multiplication, which is essentially a dynamic programming argument.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm suggesting is if you fix a destination and you change your viewpoint to some kind of function of how long it takes to get to that destination from points in space, wouldn't that sort of imply that phenomenon of the kind you described cannot occur somehow? I mean, I don't know the depth of the problem, but... I mean, rather than taking a point-to-point perspective, take a space-to-point perspective.
Yeah. Well, that is essentially the matrix-like algorithm that I described. And that can be done, yes.
So it doesn't help, basically? To resolve the question?
It doesn't... Oh, the path's coming to a stop. No, I don't think it does. Because in the end, you've just got paths. You haven't said anything about them. You've just said how you're going to get them.
More questions?
Well, they asked most of them during the talk.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's a great talk.